commitment since the passage of the bill that she described in 1973, Senate Bill 510, has been to the division, the mental health division, not to a hospital. So all these people wouldn't necessarily have to go to the hospital. They could be committed and treated locally. That part of the statute isn't being used extensively because it's difficult to move people from a lesser to a more secure setting. So if the county commits a person locally, then it's difficult if they get worse to move them to a more secure kind of setting. Impossible. But so that, I think, makes that change. So we're anticipating that the cost would be approximately $1.4 million for 85-87.
I'm sorry, how much?
$1.4
million. Thank you.
And of course, this is not included in the governor's budget at this point. And so, although we can understand the dilemma that it's placed when you're unable to treat somebody who needs treatment, this is the fiscal impact of it.
Are there questions from the committee members? Just Representative Springer.
Dr. Brady, just to understand, the $1.4 million, is that all state money, or is there any federal match involved in that, or?
That would be.
Or would this be the state's share if there is a federal match?
That's a total cost, including the federal part of it. Now, for the institutions for the mentally ill, the federal cost isn't as great a percent as it is in the institutions for the mentally retarded, as you know. So I don't have the exact percent on my with me, but that will be in the fiscal analysis.
Okay, we expect to receive that later. Thank you. I just wanted to make sure that if this did represent a mix of money, that we knew that and we can await the detailed figures later.
It'll all be in there.
Okay.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Bellamy.
Does this figure include the basic costs of the county mental health programs?
It does not. I think in our analysis, we took the position that many of these people are already being referred for evaluation, so they're already being screened, and now they're being screened out, and they would just be screened in, so that we could be wrong on that. I mean, I think it's in doing this kind of analysis, it's very difficult, as was pointed out, to be sure what will happen. And that's the best predictor, I guess, is past experience. And that's why we called up our friends north of here to see what happened to them. They didn't have any data on what happened locally. So I really was just trying to give you something I had hard data on.
Mr. Bray, could I ask you, and I don't know if you were in your present position in the 73 session or leading into the 73 session, Ms. Remington, in the written testimony that ACLU provided stated that there was a team of individuals from a variety of interests that developed the current law. Were you involved in that process?
Yes, I was. I was administrator of the Mental Health Division at that time and appointed the task group. That group was an excellent work group, did a good deal of compromising on this issue as well as a number of other issues, and I think gave us a good bill. The complaints I've heard about it since then have been mostly in the area of perhaps the scales tipping a little bit towards making it so difficult to commit somebody that they're not getting in. And most of that's anecdotal. I don't have the kind of data I'd like on that.
Do you think there's a need for a similar team to be put together, perhaps this interim, to review what's going on out there in the field today, in terms of how the law is working after 10 years, 12 years,
You might answer me a little bit on that, because it seems to me that in some counties, it seems to work differently on a county-by-county basis. And for some counties, the commitments seem to proceed without a great deal of problem. And in other counties, this broad language is interpreted differently. If being more specific would, and what it seems to me that's been called out here by the advocate groups and by the people who've supported this, is the kinds of incidences that they've experienced in their lives when they've tried to get somebody with a specific kind of problem. So it just writes a lot more of that into the statute, is with my kind of feeling about it. And a task group would be faced with the same kind of problems that we're faced with right here.
Are you suggesting that the law is not being read uniformly and applied uniformly throughout the state? Similar situations would receive similar, different results depending on the county one is living in?
That's what I said, and I wish I hadn't. The reason I wish I hadn't is I don't have the data to back that up. And
And your professional impression of what's going on.
That is an impression, and I'll tell you where I get that impression. Soon after the enactment of Senate Bill 510, we held a conference of judges in Southern Oregon to discuss it, and I heard many of them say, "This works fine for us. We're able to handle the commitments the way we need to." Other counties were saying, "We cannot commit the people we feel need to be committed under this." That puzzled me, and that's what led me to think that may be a fact, because I was hearing judges saying this. It may be something. I'm not obviously not as knowledgeable as you all about those processes, but it just gave me that sense.
Okay. Further questions from the committee members?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Bellamy.
This may be unfair to put you on the spot. You heard the the judgment of one person that indicated that the mental health law is not in good shape. Do you agree that there needs to be some look at, or we need to take some look at the statute, not the way the service is being done, but the actual statute?
I do agree that it would be useful to look at this portion of the statute of how mental illness is defined. The question is getting it set up so that it would be productive, and so that you would use in 72, when that task group came together, that group did an excellent job and were able to compromise and were able to give in on both sides and were able to recognize it. Now, if you could have a similar group working in the interim, and I guess I would encourage it to be as data-based as possible, to base it on is there in fact a difference in the commitment practices in various counties? And if there is, how might we word it to discourage that, to make it very clear, as well as agreeing on the basic bedrock issue of what is it it all boils down basically, obviously, to a public policy issue of how. Where on the scale one wants to fix the situation so that you take control of somebody's life. And obviously, some of these severe mental illnesses, and I certainly agree with Mr. Falk to include this, because if there's severe psychosis or severe mental illness makes sense, those are usually the instances that people are talking about. I guess my answer to your question basically is yes, I believe it needs looking at.
I hope you get a copy of his amendments and look at them.
I will.
Also.
Any further questions? If not, thank you very much, Doctor. Next person on the sign-up list is Judy Johnson. And Ms. Johnson's the last person I have signed up on 2640, unless we've missed someone. If we have, we'll give you an opportunity.
Good afternoon.
Welcome.
Hi. I am appearing on behalf of the Metropolitan Public Defender's Office. I am an attorney. Since January of 1984, I have worked in the civil commitment rotation and have handled civil commitment hearings on a daily basis. I won't repeat a lot of the comments I agreed with or question those that I didn't, but I do want to address some practical concerns I have about 2640. My primary concern, won't repeat Ms. Remington's testimony, but I think the bill seeks to delete what is an easily understood standard and substitute a very complex standard that only a psychiatrist could understand. This Chapter 426 is used all the time by police officers and by family members of mentally ill persons, by people who are trying to decide what's available to them in terms of the civil commitment procedure. It's a standard I can explain to my clients so that they can understand what they're faced with when they go to court. I believe it's a standard a police officer could advise a family of if he's called out to a scene involving a mentally ill person and has to advise the family of what's open to them. It is a common sense standard. Perhaps it has more than one meaning. I think there's been a substantial body of case law that's helped define exactly what it does mean. But in any event, dangerous to self or others and unable to provide for basic needs is a much simpler, much clearer standard than that proposed in the bill. My second concern is that the proposed language is overly broad. It would allow persons to be committed for property damage even though there's no indication that the property damage constituted a risk to any person. I think when you're talking about involuntary commitment and you're talking about forcing someone to submit to hospitalization and antipsychotic medication, the state should have a very good reason for getting involved in that. The current standard authorizes state intervention if there's danger to somebody's safety. I don't think it's necessary to expand that to include danger to property. I would address a comment made by someone who testified before me that it's not fair that a family should have to live in fear of violence before any action can be taken. I don't think that's the way the current standard is interpreted in the appellate cases or on a day-to-day basis. There's appellate law that says quite clearly that a court can rely on past acts plus the impressions of the examiners and the examiner's testimony in assessing the person's current mental status and the examiner's prediction of future violence. So I don't think it's correct to say that under the current statute a person can't be committed until he acts violently. I think as long as there's clear evidence that that potential is there and the examiners are able to testify to that in the proceeding, that that concern is addressed.
Mr. Chair.
Excuse me, Lieutenant Bowman.
Before you leave that point, how does one of the families ever get around to telling this part?
How do they ever get around to
telling this part about the fear, about the danger, and so forth?
Okay.
You
well,
say that the past history can be used. I'm asking you when does the family ever get to use it, present their side?
Okay, well, in terms of the commitment process, one of the ways commitment proceedings are instituted is by two persons who generally go to a mental health office and sit down with a mental health investigator and tell them of the reasons they feel this person is in need of treatment. They're going to have an opportunity at that point to relay how the person has behaved in the past when they're off their medication and suffering from mental problems. Plus any threatening conduct that may be occurring at the present, and I think that's going to be an opportunity right there. Similarly, I think it's pretty accepted that a person can testify in court as to past violent acts and that it is relevant at a mental commitment hearing such as this.
Representative Bowman.
Let me
follow up question,
that,
I think.
And I should tell the committee that I'm not a very objective witness, or very objective person on this, because a very close family friend situation develops, and I can relate to this totally. It's my experience that they almost have to get into the criminal procedures before you can get any help for them, and I guess my response is that you're telling me that, and yet I know that an individual that's 30 years of age is already into the criminal system, but they have to get in two or three times, and they never have the opportunity before a judge. The mental health people are totally supportive, but you're telling me that it is so easy, and I will tell you that it is so difficult to ever get to the point of talking to the judge or somebody about these things, and I hear you tell me it's so easy.
I don't know that I told you it's so easy. I think 426 provides a method whereby two parties can go in and sign a notice of mental illness and initiate an investigation, and that procedure is open to any two.
And I understand that, and the county mental health people will say, yes, you're right, but...
But
they've got to say that, I'm sorry, there's no way we can help you. This individual doesn't fall into the definitions. And of course, the individual I'm talking about has been into court now on criminal procedures. They still have not been able to get any of the professional people's advice, even into the judge, because it didn't directly relate to the crime.
I can't respond to that not knowing the particular situation. My point was merely that I don't think you have to hurt someone to fall within the purview of the present definition. I think that...
Well, I would agree with that. I just, you know, I think what you're telling me is that the real problem that the people say is that you say, no, we have a system. My own very first-hand experience tells me that that system may exist, but getting into it is so difficult that in reality it doesn't exist.
Okay. That may be the case. Back to my original point, I don't think changing the language to the proposed language is going to assist in that. Attempting to substitute a definition that's so complex that I don't see how a layperson could begin to understand what's available to them or whether or not a person fits.
I don't want to belabor this point because we do have a lot of people, and I know you want to conclude your remarks, but I guess to the extent that Dr. Brace suggested that there may be an inconsistency between counties in terms of the adjudication process, what standards or criteria, how each judge may apply the law as he or she understands it. I guess in turn there may be inconsistencies from counties to county in terms of the people, professional or whatever their particular job assignment may be, how they also interpret the law. And I guess I'm not sure what training exists for judges. I'm not sure what training exists from county to county to try to establish uniformity, assuming that's a desirable goal, and I think it probably is.
Well, we
might hear more about that later. I know you may not be able to respond to that, but maybe Rocky, I don't know if we have anybody from the Court Administrator's Office. At some point, we're going to need their fiscal assessment, and maybe they can respond to some of these questions as it relates to the judicial side. But
you brought up one more question, and you'd be a good person to ask. You come from the metropolitan area, which obviously has more services and more trained people readily. Would you say that it, because you deal with this area all the time, you may have the ability to help people quicker than in the rural areas where the services, there's just very few services and they don't deal with it on a day-to-day basis? I mean, you work with it every day. You may understand the avenues.
Uh-huh.
Somebody in the rural areas, could it be just the opposite? Because they're dealing with people that don't deal with it on a day-to-day basis. You've learned to manipulate the hoops and hurdles, and they have not.
Okay, in terms of legal representation, yes, I'm probably more aware of the alternatives that are available to someone facing a hearing and facing a commitment
than an attorney who handles them once in a while out in a rural county, yes. My understanding is that for every 3 notices of mental illness that are filed in Multnomah County, where I work, about 2 are withdrawn prior to hearing or result in no hearing. And so a lot of people are being taken care of through the mental health system before it ever gets to the court, through voluntary treatment, voluntarily sign themselves into a hospital. So a lot of it's resolved that way. One last point I'd like to make is something Mr. Falk touched on, and that was that the current standard or the current legislation does have some different standards inside. There are some inconsistencies and some language that's troublesome. I think that 2640 is only going to exacerbate that problem. The whole commitment proceeding starts with a notice of mental illness. It's generally accomplished by one of 3 groups, either a police officer based on dangerousness to self or others, a doctor based on evidence of dangerousness to self or others, or 2 parties based on dangerousness to self or others, or basic needs. And then the same standard pretty much applies at the hearing, so the evidence must then rise to the level of clear and convincing evidence. The proposed language, by changing the definition of mental illness, establishes a new standard for a hold by 2 persons. The 2 persons would then have to assert that the person is mentally ill under the new definition. But for a doctor signing a hold or a police officer signing a hold, that same language would exist about dangerousness to self or others. And so I think you're creating a major internal inconsistency by a change in the definition without.
Okay. Ms. Johnson, I appreciate that point. I'm not sure, since we don't have the whole statute before us, we might ask counsel when and if this comes up next to make sure we do have copies of the specific statute for the police hold and the physician's hold.
So okay, I'd like to submit something in writing anyway.
Sure.
I think it might clarify things. That was basically my last point. I think that the new standard is going to create some internal problems that are. You're going to have different people signing holds for different standards, which is going to add further confusion. But in summary, I think the present standard is a clear one. It's one that laymen and professionals can understand as well. It's a reasonable standard, and my conclusion is don't muck it up. I think the language proposed is going to create a lot more problems than it solves.
Thank you, Ms. Johnson. Any further questions? If not, we'll look forward to receiving the written information you submit.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. I believe that's it for those who've signed up on 2640. Let me know if I've missed anyone.
Do you know when your work session will be?
We have not scheduled that yet. My estimate, probably a couple weeks. Probably a couple weeks. So we want to allow ample opportunity to prepare amendments or to receive written material. If you have a question about that, you can call the committee office with the toll-free access number, and we'll try to let you know as soon as possible.
I regret at this point having been through 15 commitment hearings for my son that I didn't write some. I think I should.
If you want to do that later and submit that to us, we'd be glad to receive it. You bet. And that applies to anyone. Okay, thank you. That's often the case. Folks like a chance to respond. Let's move on then to the next bill that we have on our agenda. That is 2651. I'd like to follow basically the same ground rules. We'll follow the individuals as listed here on the sign-up sheet. Please try to not repeat comments that may have been made by a previous speaker. If you could indicate that you endorse that person's opinion, we would appreciate that. If you do have anything in writing now or would like to submit additional written comments, we'd be glad to receive those. If anyone failed to sign up for some reason and would like to testify, just pass a note up to us and we'll allow you that opportunity. And we'll go ahead and start with Bob King with the Clackamas County Mental Health Center. And uh, for members' information while Mr. King is coming forward, this measure 2651 would basically allow minors 14 and over to obtain outpatient mental health counseling without parental consent in most cases, and Mr. King will tell us more about this. Welcome.
For the record, I'm Bob King, director of the Clackamas County Mental Health Center. I have some written testimony that will be passed out to you, but in view of the time and in view of the fact that I have a child care problem in Portland at 6 o'clock, I will summarize my testimony to you. There were two bills introduced in 1981 that dealt with this issue, which also deals with the intersection between two different sets of rights, at least the rights and prerogatives of parents and the rights and needs of children who have problems with mental illness or alcohol or drug abuse or who might be suicidal. The two bills in 1981 were eventually combined, passed by both houses, and vetoed by the governor, and a copy of his letter explaining that veto is attached. We did not do anything in the last session, but became aware that some other states had attempted to address this issue in a satisfactory way, and we have tried to draft a bill that will meet some of the concerns, I think, that any citizen or parent would have. The bill before you, with the amendments that we would like to propose to this bill, limits the type of treatment permissible without parental consent to outpatient treatment, but would exclude methadone maintenance from that. It would extend this authorization only to the licensed mental health professions of psychiatry, psychology, nurse practitioners, and clinical social workers, and certain community mental health clinics pursuant to an administrative rule that would govern that process. We have tried in the bill with the amendments to state a clear policy directive that parents are to be involved in the treatment plan as soon as it is clinically feasible. There is a provision in the bill that would allow the professional person to act without sanctions if it became evident that the adolescent needed a more secure or intensive treatment in an inpatient or residential setting. And as previously, the bill would provide that parents are not financially responsible for treatment costs to which they have not consented. I think the question that I would suspect that's in your mind is, you know, how do these kids come to our attention, and what can we do about it? Most of what's brought to my attention are situations where teenagers call us on the telephone and come into our kind of intake process, if you will, and they are testing us out very warily from a safe distance as to whether they could come in and be seen without parental consent. Now, I don't have to deal in my county with very many street kids, but in Multnomah County, there certainly would be other kinds of situations where youngsters would be coming in much more direct contact with some mental health professionals and still wanting to get some kind of help and not have parental consent. The amendments that we would like to see attached to the bill are attached to my testimony, as well as a rather sloppy, hand-engrossed version of the amendments that I would like to see. These amendments arose out of some meetings that I had with people that work particularly in the area of alcohol and drug abuse, and we felt that they would clarify our concern for that area as well as for the suicidal and the possibly mentally ill adolescent. The final point that I would like to make is that there is some concern, particularly among the alcohol and drug treatment people, that the age 14 is not sufficient, and that we ought to consider going down to age 12. The amendments that I proposed still maintain the age 14, because that was the consensus of at least the association that I'm trying to represent. But I personally became convinced that after the sessions with dialoguing with the people in the alcohol and drug abuse area, that we probably should go down to that age. But that's just my personal position. I think at that point, in view of the time, I'll stop my testimony and respond to questions.
Okay. Representative Bunn.
I have a hard time understanding for sure the magnitude of the problem and the reason there's a need for this, and part of it may be I haven't had an opportunity to review all the letters and amendments, but there are a whole series of areas where parents that I have viewed in my lifetime do things with and to their children that I don't think are beneficial in my judgment to those children, involving their physical care, their mental care. But our state has made a judgment that except for special problem areas, we're going to reserve to parents the right to raise their children, even though I disagree with the way they do that. What is occurring now that says we need to invade that situation and draw children to this kind of help without having the parent involvement?